Okay. Thank you so much to John and to Dan, and welcome to those tuning in on Wave Farm Radio. We will now be handing over for a post-movie screening discussion to Ghost Fleet producer John Bauermaster for a conversation with Hudson-based filmmaker Daniel McCabe. John Bauermaster is a writer, filmmaker, and adventurer. He's a six-time grantee of the National Geographic Expeditions Council, one of the Society's ocean heroes. John's first assignment for National Geographic magazine in 1989 was to document a dog sled expedition that crossed Antarctica, taking 221 days. He is the founder of Ocean's 8 Films and One Ocean Media Foundation. You can listen to his podcast, The Green Radio Hour with John Bauermaster, on Radio Kingston. Daniel McCabe is a New York-based filmmaker and photographer. His journalistic work has appeared in National Geographic, The New York Times, Time Magazine, BBC, Al Jazeera, and CNN, among others. Daniel's first feature-length documentary film, This is Congo, premiered at the prestigious 74th Venice Biennale and has won numerous awards worldwide, as well as having been shown here at Basilica. Dan will also be the Basilica Back Gallery September Artist in Residence with an exhibition of new photographic work. And I'll hand over to John and to Dan.
John, I mean, round of applause. Whoa. I usually don't do moderating. So forgive me for not knowing what I'm doing, but wow,
it's just
John,
a conversation.
Yeah, incredible film. I think we could just jump right into it. I've got a bunch of questions, and I'm sure you guys do as well. I had no idea. I'm trying to remember back to your opening words about slavery, and I mean, my God, I had no idea. I know you mentioned that it's just a small percentage of human trafficking slavery that's in the fishing industry, and it seemed like a massive, massive problem and something where it's like you just go off into international waters and boom, you're gone. You can't get off.
Nobody really, and we've asked and asked and asked and asked, no one really has a number for how many of these men are enslaved on fishing boats around the world. It would be a pretty easy problem to solve. You know, when you go up in an airplane, every airplane, big, small, whatever size, there's a little black box that tells you who's on the boat, who's the captain, who's the assistant captain, who are the passengers, who are the staff, et cetera. And that, so the technology exists. The fishing companies resist that, obviously, because they, you know, we've talked prior to the screening about the fact that, you know, the reason that they get away with this is because they're trying to cut down on costs, because since we've so badly overfished the oceans, they're having to go further and further to find fish, and so they're looking for ways to reduce their expenditures, and one easy line item for them to cross off their Excel spreadsheet is labor. And they do it by, you know, traditional ways. They trick them, they promise them jobs, they go into little towns in Cambodia and Laos, Thailand, and say, who needs a job? You know, and half the population holds up their hand. They say, okay, you know, gather up $200 and meet us on this dock on X day, and, you know, we'll give you a job in a canning factory or a shrimp factory or or a boat, but we'll give you a job. And then they show up, and then they never get paid. And a lot of these guys end up out in the middle of the ocean. They don't see land for years, which is phenomenal to me. Because these motherships come out and pick up the fish and take them to shore, et cetera. And if and when they do see land, they're so intimidated by the fact that they've been threatened and intimidated on these boats that they hesitate to escape, because they know, they're savvy enough to know that they don't know who to trust on land. If they escape, they go on land, and all of a sudden they meet a policeman. Often the policemen are in bed with the boat companies. So, and they know that. They know that.
Well, and as we saw in the film, you know, also shame and pride get woven into it too, where so much time has gone by and they left for one reason. And, incredible. How, just to step back, How did you stumble upon the story, and what's kind of the genesis of how this even emerged?
Yeah, well, I'd spent, somehow, I conned National Geographic into funding a 10-year-long project where we went around the world one continent at a time looking at the relationship between man and the ocean. And so I'd done lots of traveling at sea level, literally around the world, and they had this little category, National Geographic Ocean Heroes. I'm the only one who's not a marine biologist. I'm interested in people, and I'm a storyteller, so I need people to help me tell that story. So you're out there, you're traveling, and you hear these stories of this existing, this fact that the boats are using guys and they're not paying them. So I started gathering the information to make a film on the subject, and in the meantime, I heard a report on NPR on All Things Considered. It was a two-part story in the morning. It was done by a radio journalist named Shannon Service, and did this phenomenal reporting on this notion that there are these slaves on boats around the world. And a year later or so, I was introduced to Shannon. She'd never made a film. And she lives in San Francisco or in the Bay Area. She'd gone to a women's conference or a women's lunch in San Francisco. She sat next to Wendy Schmidt, who is the wife of Eric Schmidt, who is the CEO of Google. And Wendy has a great interest in ocean issues. And Shannon explained the story to her, and Wendy wrote her a check for $35,000. So they went out and made a trailer. But then once they made a trailer, they couldn't go any further. So I kind of helped them. We agreed to partner. I ended up raising the money. And then, well, we raised the money to shoot it, but then we needed money to finish it. And that's when I approached Paul Allen, the Microsoft co-founder, who had this great passion for ocean issues. And he committed to the project immediately. And it was with Vulcan Productions that we were able to kind of pull it off. Because it was not, we didn't even think about it. I mean, kind of thought about it as we were making it, but it's in six languages, none of which is English. It's a tough sell in an American audience to, convince people to go watch a documentary that's subtitled in another language. We can go a little deeper with this, but we've had really good success with the film. It premiered at Telluride last Labor Day. It showed a bunch of times at Toronto Film Festival and had its European premiere at the Berlin Festival. Shown around the world, it showed at the Vatican, it showed at the UN. We brought Patima and her team to Telluride, to Toronto, to the UN. I mean, they're incredibly moving stuff.
And I see you guys won a ton of awards as well.
Yeah, and in Telluride, Tun Lin, the fellow who's working with Patima now, who had been the enslaved, he got up on the stage in Telluride. He speaks no English, and he just said, I was born in the dirt, literally. And he said, now I'm on a stage in Telluride, Colorado. I'm in this film. I have no words. And he was incredibly moved. And he walked outside, and there was Laura Dern and Emma Stone and Alice Waters, waiting to give him a big hug. And he was even more blown away. So Vatican, UN, et cetera, it's all great, but our biggest screening is coming up, and it's in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Why is that the biggest?
Why? I don't know. Why is that the biggest? Walmart. There you go. Because this is all about the supply chain. The fish that these guys catch, and this is an argument that I have with my own team, the fish that these guys catch does not, what's the restaurant up here? Godfathers and Sons or Farmers and Sons. Yeah, you go up there and order a piece of tuna. It's not going to be a fish that these guys caught, okay? But how many of you have pets? Yeah, if you go and buy pet food, a lot of it has fish in it, and most of or a lot of what these guys catch is chopped up and turned into pet food. In the U.S. market, the pet food business is $30 billion a year. $30 billion a year. And Walmart sells a third of that. So Walmart sells $10 billion of pet food a year. And all we're asking them is to trace that supply chain and see where that product comes from. To their credit, they're way ahead. I mean, they've been, it's not just us and this film, they've been on this issue. They get it. They know. They're actually, you know, we can, you know, chide them for whatever we want, but they're actually pretty green in a lot of respects, and they're on this. They're trying to figure out how to source pet food that's not, doesn't come from mulched up fish caught by slaves.
Non-slave pet food.
Yeah, but you know, when you go into buy fish at Adams, for example, I mean, it tells you where the fish is from.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
But it doesn't say, you know, caught by slaves. I mean, how are you? I mean, that's almost impossible. The division to make.
Totally. Let's turn this over to you guys. Any questions? Just shout them out. If we can't hear them, I'll let you know. Here in the back.
Yeah, that's another kind of, Robert, as you know from making films yourself, a lot of these, the language in these things gets parsed pretty fine. The Associated Press won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting this story. You know, we weren't the first, and there was after they won the Pulitzer Prize, there was another story that the AP wrote, same team, about these slave fishing boats pulling into ports in Honolulu, and the U.S. not doing anything about it. They recognized the fact that these guys, they could see what was happening. These guys, they would get off the boat. They were like, you know, whipped dogs. You know, they were hesitant. They were scared. They didn't want to even go to the public restrooms, etc. And they knew what was going on, but they didn't do anything about it. And in this case, they were selling the fish to the local equivalent of Whole Foods and restaurants, etc. Wasn't going to pet food. So that's the reference into the fact that the U.S. and the United Kingdom have kind of recognized this stuff and not acted out maybe as they should have. These boats, they may originate in Thailand and Indonesia, but they work all around the world. Tunlin, for a couple years, was off the coast of Somalia. You know, they're everywhere. But again, as I said in the little introduction, you know, the reason this exists is because we've so badly overfished the ocean that they're having to go further and further and further to find fish. And, you know, one way for them to make more profit is to not pay the workers.
Any other questions here in the front?
Is the seafood at Walmart caught for human consumption? You know, I'll be quite frank. I've never shopped at Walmart for seafood, so I'm not quite sure. I doubt it's caught by slaves. It really is. You saw the images of. I mean, there was archival footage in there of them catching all the bycatch, just massive nets, just dropping it on. No discrimination over what fish is which or trying to. They just, you know, pile it all up together And they do the same thing off the coast of Alaska, you know, but it's not slaves. But, I mean, the way they catch fish and turn it into fish meal, basically, which is used in everything from, you know, what do they call the thing at McDonald's?
Filet-O-Fish.
I mean, everything, yeah, and to pet food. We, you know, the composer who did the score for the film complained somewhat jokingly that the film has three endings. And we almost added a fourth. I mean, the one thing we did not address is, okay, Fatima goes out, she finds these guys, and she's been very successful in identifying them. The problem is they end up in these remote places. They have no ID. They have no money. They can't travel. They don't trust anyone. They end up initially living in these jungle scenarios. Oftentimes, if they've been there, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, they settle down, they start a family, etc. But when they found the epilogue that we opted not to include was about the men in this case that she did find, She did help repatriate. And on the last island, the three guys, Yod, who they didn't expect to find, he went back. He was thrilled. He you know, still living a good life. Nong, the guy in the orange T-shirt, whose grandmother was, his wife's mother, his grandmother was weeping, and et cetera. He went back. He got his papers in order, and then he returned to the island. It's good. But Pong, the very sweet young guy who reconnected with his father, was killed in a motorcycle or a scooter accident not so long after. Because being repatriated, finding your way back home is just a small part, first step of the issue. They suffer from whatever their equivalent of PTSD is. They've been enslaved and whipped and beaten and lived this horrible life, and now they're trying to explain this to their people. And so he was, drugs and beer and et cetera.
Sure, sure.
That's a whole other part of the story that we didn't even approach.
But the mental health side, yeah.
Yeah. Patima, if you met her, and we've had really good fortune, and she's just thrilled. We've been able to bring her to several events, and she's about that tall, and she's this Buddha-like character. You can see it in the film. She never yells. She doesn't raise her voice. She's very calm. She talks to these guys in a very measured level, and just in her eyes, you can see there's something really unique about her. But the fact that, in the film, you only see, half dozen people that she actually kind of helps return to home, but she's done that for 5,000 men and continues. You see her sleeping in a mattress with her son and her husband. That's in their office. That's her life. So she's great. Speaks not so much English. But again, but we've had the good fortune to bring her around and have her come to some of these events, and she's great.
Right here in the middle.
Yeah, I'm not sure who puts up those grave, the markers, etc. Yeah, but I'm sure there is contact made. One of Petima's kind of idealistic goals is to, move some of those graves back to Thailand. I'm not sure that will happen, but she's still out there, and the film's actually been very helpful to them. They've raised a fair amount of money so they can, continue to go out and identify and find these guys and help them go back home.
So that's obviously to say, if we want to help, we can get in touch with that organization and help support that.
Yep, which is a good thing to do.
Anybody else here in the front?
Yeah, the politics of Thailand v. Indonesia. Yeah, I'm not an expert, but I know a little bit. A couple things. The head of the fisheries agency in Indonesia is a woman. Her name is Susi. I can't pronounce her last name, but she has a international reputation for seizing illegal fishing boats. And there's a fine line, but there's a line between illegal fishing and fishing by slaves. Illegal fishing is, every country gets 200 miles basically off their coast, which is their prerogative, their fishing grounds. And anyone who comes into that and from another country and fishes is fishing illegally. So she goes after these guys, and she seizes their boats and she blows them up. You can literally search like Susi, S-U-S-I, Indonesia, and you find pictures of her blowing up these boats. We interviewed her, but it didn't quite fit with the story. We wrestled a little bit with including the Prime Minister of Thailand in the film, because obviously he was showing up. He showed up because Petima has been getting pretty good press. He was just trying to come to kind of make sure that he didn't get left out of that story. He never addresses the issue of slavery. He says, oh yes, we have to stop illegal fishing, etc. But we thought it was interesting that he had kind of came to them. you know, which was cool.
I think it all showed pretty well on film.
Yeah,
exactly the kind of guy he was.
Well, and just within the last month, he had kind of seized the government. He's an army guy. He's a military guy. He had seized the government and named himself prime minister. But in the last 1 or 2 months, there was an election. He was elected. But now he's got to face a Congress that is divided. So it's gonna be interesting to watch. One question we often get is, why didn't we name names in terms of who are the bad guys? In terms of who are the bad fishing companies, who are the bad distributors of the fish that these guys catch, et cetera. And it was an argument that we had, within our own team, because we didn't. The biggest exporter of fish in Thailand is a company called Thai Union, which is has deep connections with the government as well. And at least on the face of it, they're trying to change. They've hired some scientists to run their, part of their exporting business or to oversee their exporting business. Our feeling was, if we name names, then these guys are going to be labeled as bad guys forever. Because with the film, you can't really change it. You can't go back and edit those names out. We thought, rather than brand them as bad guys, let's encourage them to do the right thing and use the film. So, will it work? We don't know. The film has shown in Thailand a couple times, and they didn't arrest anybody or throw anybody out. I think they're willing to kind of roll with it.
Which may have been different had you named names, I imagine.
Perhaps, yeah. If we'd gone after Thai Union, which is the biggest exporter and with a great tie into the government, yeah, they would definitely been they would have had a different perspective.
Any other questions? Here.
I guess the question is, does the public at large understand that this kind of kidnapping and shanghaiing and enslaving happens? I think it does. I mean, I think they do, but we have no empirical evidence of it. I'm sure it still continues. I'm sure tonight there's somebody being grabbed off a street in Bangkok and hustled onto a boat. But it's hard to measure. Just as it's hard to measure how many of them are enslaved, it's hard to measure how many of them are kind of, continuing to be. But that's why I think, I'm a big believer that media makes a difference. This film is shown around the world now and will continue to show around. And it's just a small piece, but people are talking about it and people are not, more knowledgeable about it. And I hope it helps. Thank you. Hold it. How did that go? Thank you for this horrifying film. Is that what, I'm sorry? Most of these guys escape because they eventually the boats will come near to shore and they just say, fuck it, and they jump and swim for it, and then they end up living in the jungles. But again, keeping in mind that now they don't trust anybody. And the fact that Fatima is when we were on the boat with her in Indonesia, Fatima had the kind of was able to instill them with the confidence that okay, I met you 15 minutes ago, come with me, I'm going to help you, is a big credit to her, because they're so untrusting of everyone. Yeah, my favorite is Pong, who ends up on the phone with his father, and the Oi, the translator, is trying to explain she doesn't even really try to explain, but assuming that he understands what Facebook is. He has no idea. He has no idea what Facebook is. He's just kind of nodding his head and sees his picture and recognizes some names, and next thing he knows, he's on the phone with his father. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, there are, in a weird way, some good uses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Walmart and their own employees. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they do pay them. Maybe not enough, but they do pay them. Yeah.
We'll do one or two more, and then we'll turn it over to the bar conversation. So right here in the middle. How long were you shooting, and how long was the edit?
Yeah, well, the whole project was 6+ years, 7 years. You know, we shot in Indonesia on several different trips. Editing took year and a half, probably. You know, we got it to a certain point where it just, you know, we did everything we could, and it wasn't quite what we wanted to be, and then we brought in a couple really experienced other eyes to have a look at it, and that, you know, that took more time and more money, etc. But yeah, it was a long. I do give big credit to Vulcan Productions for signing on for the whole ride, because you know they committed to one thing and they ended up paying quite a different thing, but they really believed in it and been hugely supportive. I mean, it's great. You know, any of us who work in the documentary world know that. You know, it's hard to find support at that kind of monetary level, and that they believed in it. And every step of the way, we've had incredible support. Every festival we went to, we'd meet these people who would come forward and say, you know, how can I help? And there was sometimes it was, you know, word of mouth. Sometimes it was money, and it's really been a powerful experience. But each film is different, and you know we're on to whatever's next, and you know, hoping that some of the same good juju will continue.
Last one. Any last ones here?
What is next?
Oh, me? Jeez. Well, not a film about the fishing slavery industry. Well, I've got a thing coming up here at Basilica that's a still photography project, but I've got a few films in the works. One's about grasshoppers. So, kind of like fishing, but no slaves. So, what are you working on?
Well, I'm lucky I juggled this kind of stuff, this slightly bigger, long-term, more expensive, et cetera, with this long series that we've been doing the last 5 years called the Hudson River Stories, where it started out looking at environmental issues here in the Hudson Valley and making films about them. And now it's morphed into this, what we're calling the Hope on the Hudson series, where we're making films about kind of good news stories, optimistic stories here in our backyard. I've had really good luck. I've made films literally on every continent, but you know I live here and I've lived here for 30 odd years, and I'm really happy to be making these. They're short films. They're 15, 25 minutes. We have a new one, but because they're short, that you can kind of finish them quickly. So it seems like there's a lot of them out there. But we've got a new one coming August 15th, actually, called A Living River. We spent 2 years documenting wildlife, and we're not wildlife guys. You know, that's not our expertise. We're people guys, but we were able to tell the story of wildlife through people, and it's powerful. You know, up and down the Hudson River. I mean, we went out and we caught these 8, 9, 10-foot-long sturgeon, tiny little glass eels about that big who travel up from the Sargasso Sea all the way up the Hudson River and into the tributaries. The herring have returned in a big way. So that's fun. Yeah, HudsonRiverStories.com. You can see all the stuff we've done on that front, which is I'm quite happy with.
John, thanks so much. All of you, thank you for coming. Thursday nights, there's two more left, right? The next two Thursdays, come check it out.